Thanks, everyone, for being here today. Really excited to host this panel. And I'd like to start off by introducing the panelists. First, we have Dodd Kitsley. He's a director at Davis Advisors, and he also serves as the head of ETF strategy. Matt Goulet is seated next to him. He's the vice president of sector investment strategy at Fidelity. And then Mo Hagman, who's the head of product beta solutions at Oppenheimer. So thank you for being here today. Looking forward to a great discussion. And I thought maybe it would be great for each of you to just start by introducing yourself. Tell us a little bit about your ETF business and where it sits within your firm, and in particular Smart Beta, since that's the focus of our panel, or one of the focus.
Fantastic. I guess I'll start. Good afternoon, everybody. Dodd Kitsley. I head up ETF strategy at Davis Advisors. For those of you who were here in the morning, you saw Chris Davis, our chairman and portfolio manager, speak. We are a privately owned fundamental asset manager, equity specialist, $27 billion in assets, and been around since 1969. But I was brought in to the firm about 9 months ago to help drive their ETF business, and we launched three transparent, actively managed ETFs in January of this year. So it's our first entrance into the space, but they are truly active. There's no benchmark. They're not smart beta, so very much looking forward to the conversation with these gentlemen.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. Hopefully you can hear me okay. Matt Goulet from Fidelity, and there's really two ways to think about Fidelity from an ETF perspective. One is the brokerage, the custody, the clearing platform, and in that space, Fidelity is a giant. It's $315 billion in ETF assets under administration, and that's across our retail accounts held through Fidelity branches or RIAs that are custody and clearing on our platform. The part of the business I'm representing today is Fidelity's proprietary ETF lineup. And we offer all three flavors, passive, smart beta, and full-blown active. In the passive space, we have passively managed sector ETFs. In the smart beta space, we have individual equity factor ETFs. And in the active space, we have fully transparent, actively managed fixed income ETFs. And on today's panel, we'll talk a little bit about why we chose to launch specific products for each of those asset classes.
Great. Mo Hagman from Oppenheimer Funds. We actually entered the smart beta space in Q4 of 2015 through an acquisition. Our focus in regards to ETF products is very much the strategic beta or smart beta section of the market. We don't currently offer any products in traditional cap-weighted indices or active ETFs. Oppenheimer Funds historically is an active shop, so it's been around since 1959, roughly $250 billion in assets under management. The ETF business, although new, is roughly $2.1 billion in assets across seven strategies that really just remove kind of the price weight from an index. So it's an alternatively weighted methodology, and we can get into that a bit more.
Okay, great. And so each of your firms obviously has a very strong active presence and a long history of such. So perhaps it would be helpful to talk about what led the entry into the passive, what was behind the thinking, and then how does it fit in your firm's overall umbrella?
I guess I'll start. We'll go down the line. So we didn't actually enter into the passive, but I think it's very common where folks will equate ETFs with passive, and we kind of view ETFs as a delivery vehicle, another way to deliver an exposure, whether it's an index exposure, whether it's exposure to a market segment or a smart beta type of strategy, factor strategy, or taking it the next step further, delivering a active type of strategy. So really simple and true, the reason we got in this space is clients asked for it. We had many existing clients that were either transitioning their book of business to more of an ETF-focused type of practice, and they said, boy, you know, we really would like to have your time-tested investment discipline in an ETF wrapper. And so we explored that a year and a half ago. There were several different options. We could have gone the smart beta route and tried to distill our investment discipline down into a set of rules. But the quick answer to that is we weren't able to do it because we think a lot of our value add is the experience in judgment, which I think distinguishes active management from a rules-based smart beta type of strategy. So we didn't go that route. The next one was like, well, Do we need to go with a non-transparent structure? Because a lot of active managers are particularly concerned with daily disclosure of holdings. And our answer to that, and Stars really aligned, was no, we don't care about disclosing on a daily basis for a couple reasons. One is the way we manage money, which is in large liquid securities, long-term horizon, low turnover, so the concern around front-running wasn't a big deal. The next question is around, do you want to give away the secret sauce of your active strategy? And again, we have embraced transparency and view that as a virtue, not a limitation. And we believe investors do have the right to understand every line item and our holdings. So that was very aligned culturally for us. So it was, I think, really a marriage of being able to deliver our strategy in something that exists today and that investors were familiar with.
And certainly that's consistent with your longer-term strategy. So how do you differentiate in terms of why even offer the ETF product? Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot of advisors were wanting to access us through an ETF format. So it's not an abandonment at all whatsoever of the mutual fund structure. We think there's certainly merits to that, and there are things we can do in the mutual fund that we can't do in the ETF, such as owning private placements or investing in illiquids. Those sort of things we think would be more challenging, at least on the equity side. So we just wanted to offer different ways, really based on client demand and advisor demand in terms of what suited their practice. We also have a huge business in separately managed accounts. But Chris always tells a story about when the firm started in 1969, a lot of folks were like, at the time, he and his dad, rather, was really an institutional asset manager. And a lot of people questioned, well, why do you want to offer these things called mutual funds to retail? It was almost like it's a little below you. You're an institutional money manager. He sees this as kind of no different right now, right? It's like we're just delivering the same thing we have. The same way we manage money that we've done since day one. It's just in a different format. And a lot of, again, clients' demand and client preferences will really drive, do you want the SMA, do you want the mutual fund, do you want the ETF?
And ETFs certainly have a halo effect now. That's something I've seen in working at Fidelity. If you're a retail customer and you go to Fidelity.com, we still have them in different sections of the website. So you start before you make any investment decision on deciding ETF versus mutual fund. And if your investment capability doesn't show up in ETF screener tool, which is getting more and more popular, then your investment capability is not offered to the customer. So I think in some cases I've seen a little bit of a halo effect with ETFs where people are gravitating towards them. They think of them as low cost or tax efficient, and that may or may not be true, but they want the ETF wrapper available for all investment strategies. And that's so similar to Dodd. We've got to be where the customers are. We believe in the structure, and it's just making our investment capabilities available in the wrappers that we believe in. Mutual fund, ETF, CIT, managed account, doesn't matter. Just make it available to the customer. I thought I'd spend a couple minutes, if that's okay, talking about our evolution of kind of how we got to active. I think I joined the firm 5 years ago, and I've always thought of Fidelity as an active shop, and they certainly are. We believe in active management. But one of the things I didn't know was just how big our indexing business is. So everyone knows of the number one index-based mutual fund provider in the country for mutual funds, but they don't know that Fidelity is number two, and by a wide margin. So we have literally hundreds of billions of dollars in index-based mutual funds. So it wasn't too difficult working internally to convince people that ETFs and that passive made sense. At the time, and this is going back to 2013, we formed a partnership with BlackRock iShares. So many of the iShares ETFs trade commission-free on the Fidelity platform. They're actually the sub-advisor for passive, for our sector ETFs. And our feeling there was, if you're going to go passive, you want the lowest price product possible. So for our sector ETFs, they're the cheapest on the market. And you want the best in class in terms of portfolio management. That's why we hired BlackRock iShares. But as we went down that path and we saw the growth in the sector ETFs, we started thinking about how to wrap different investment capabilities in the ETF wrapper. The next stop for us was transparent for fixed income. That's an asset class where it was easy for us to think about the ETF structure and the transparency of the holdings on a daily basis. We didn't have the concern that we still have today with equities where we're worried about front running, we're worried about leakage of information. Fixed income, as you all know, is a totally different market. So we felt comfortable with the transparency of the ETF wrapper. And if you look at the ETFs we've launched, they're not technically clones, but they're very similar to their mutual fund counterparts that have been on the market for 30 years. So the team up in Merrimack, New Hampshire, that's led by Ford O'Neill, they run our total bond ETF. They run our total bond mutual fund. So they were Morningstar's fund manager team of the year last year. That same team runs the ETF portfolio. Very similar holdings across both, and similar price points too. So both the ETF and the mutual fund are priced at 45 basis points, which kind of goes back to the theme of just offering choice to the customer. We don't actually have a tilt of putting people into an ETF versus mutual fund. They're priced the same way from our perspective. And then the last piece, and I think this is the most interesting part of it, is the smart beta component of it. I think that was another evolution for us where I certainly came to Fidelity with the impression that we had these portfolio managers who would make decisions on individual stocks based on fundamental bottoms-up research. That's certainly true, but what I didn't know is we had a 25-person quant team that was embedded in the research process that met with the active PMs on a weekly basis, daily basis in some cases, told them where their overweight momentum, where their overweight low volatility, is that a factor bet they're trying to make in the portfolio? So that quant embedded quant process has been something we've been doing for literally decades. There was no reason we couldn't bundle those rules-based processes up and launch them in an ETF. And that's what we did back in September. So I know that's kind of a long answer, but it's been an evolution for us. And I think where we go from here is continuing to deliver active in both rules-based and transparent wrappers for the customers. I don't see us doing a ton in the passive space going forward.
Yeah, so at Oppenheimer, you know, I think these gentlemen actually summed it up very nicely. It's a demand thing, right? So supply is meeting demand. Clients are increasingly asking for strategies at an efficient price point with transparency. And really, we're moving away from an organization that's focused on a product, and we're focusing more on what are our clients asking for and how can we deliver that. So we think of ourselves as more of a solutions provider. Now, it sounds kind of silly, but that's really what we're trying to become. And when our clients are demanding a different structure or a different set of strategies, we want to be the provider of choice. One thing I'll say in terms of the evolution of thinking, I actually agree with Matt in the sense that I was not aware when I joined the firm that we had a 23-person quant team at Oppenheimer Funds, right? Because Oppenheimer Funds is known as a fundamental, high-conviction, active shop. But similar to, I think, your experience, what I found out is there are quantitative capabilities embedded within a lot of these organizations, and it's very, very attractive to utilize things that active managers have been doing for many, many years, create rules around them, and deliver them to our clients at a different price point. I think some of the demand from the clients are coming from reasons that I think everyone understands, right? Fees, right? Fees is a big deal. Regulation is adding more pressure on fees. Additionally, I think people are looking for better diversification. So traditional cap weight has some intended biases, unintended biases. Active managers will have certain biases, right? So to Matt's point, even active managers will take factor bets in their portfolios, right? So in order to diversify or be precise in the exposures you want in your own portfolio, you may need the tools to supplement or complement an active manager. And lastly, risk reduction. I think some of the very popular strategies in the market are really focused on reducing risk in a portfolio and doing it in a certain way that clients can understand, right? So they don't have to worry necessarily about somebody coming in the morning and making a decision and then that decision going wrong. They kind of understand what's going on in the portfolio, right? They can do their due diligence and understand the strategy. So our view in the space is similar to Matt and Dodd. We really don't think we can add a ton more value in the traditional cap weight space. We actually believe those products are pretty good products. The products that are on the market today are great products. They're offered at a very low fee. They track their indices extremely tight. So we don't really necessarily think we can do that better. What we do think we can do better is that space in between active and passive. And given our history as an active manager over the last 60 years, we think the packaging of some of these ideas into rules-based strategies and delivered to clients at a better price point is the way forward.
Okay, great. And so obviously it is clear from the discussion that not all ETFs are passive. In fact, some would argue that nothing is passive. But when we think about active, when we think about smart beta, perhaps it would be interesting just to hear your views. And maybe, Mo, we can start with you because I know you've talked about sort of how you view the different buckets of smart beta. And so smart beta versus active, versus passive? How should we be thinking about that, and where you think the opportunities are?
Yeah, and I think I want to make clear. So our view on traditional passive, smart beta, and active is they all belong in the portfolio. In certain instances, it really depends on the use case or the outcome that you're looking for. So we're not saying one is better than the other necessarily. It really depends on the outcome or the objective that you're trying to meet. In terms of the way we think about it, look, I think smart beta very much is a marketing term, right? It's something that came on the scene 4 or 5 years ago. No one really likes that term. I think people tried to say strategic beta or factor beta. There's been some discussion around that term. Smart beta, does that imply that there's dumb beta? I think people are struggling with that terminology, but the reality is that it's pretty simple. It's based on things that are academically supported actually for decades, right? So these factor premiums that Matt and Dodd alluded to, these things are actually documented, supported academically, and even, if you look at performance history, you will see that there is premiums attached to some of the things that these strategies intend to give you exposure to. So for me, simplicity is important. So the way I bucket smart beta is alternatively weighted, and that includes equally weighting something, that includes fundamentally weighting something. So picking a metric like revenue or dividends or earnings and reweighting an index. The second bucket is single factor products, and I'm sure everyone's familiar with those products. Low volatility, value, size, quality, yield. Those are different in the sense that they try to give you a very precise exposure to a factor, and they rebalance intentionally to give you that factor exposure over time. And then lastly, the third bucket is bringing two or more of those single factors together in a portfolio in a way that makes sense and maybe adds a little diversification. The fourth bucket, I know that I said three. I mean, there's another category. Everything has another category. And, there are some things like thematic products or products that are maybe very focused on parts of the market where investors don't necessarily have good access, like, for example, the Chinese equity or bond market. So there are products that, have a smart beta label because they're giving you access to a part of the market that you traditionally would not have access to. And I think to be fair to those strategies, I will include them in smart beta as well.
So from my perspective, one of the things we talked a lot about when we were naming our products and how we categorize and how we enhance the customer experience on our website is relying on search engine data. So you can look at search data and say, okay, what are people actually searching for that leads them to smart beta products or active ETFs? And I ran it through the query system, and we looked at smart beta, strategic beta, factor-based, enhanced, and every term you could come up with. If you add all of those up, they weren't half of what you see in terms of search results for terms like dividend ETF or income ETF or even volatility ETF. So one of the things we've started to do on our website, especially for the retail front end, is naming them as the solution and not necessarily as the separate category for smart beta or strategic beta as Morningstar's done. The other thing I've started to notice is third parties are starting to combine ETFs and mutual funds, which is a good thing. So in October, I think it was of last year, Morningstar started grouping ETFs and mutual funds together in the same category. So now if you're looking at star ratings, if you're looking at risk-adjusted performance, you're getting them all together. You don't have to do separate queries anymore. I think that's where many of the custodial platforms and third-party research firms will go, is bucketing ETFs and mutual funds together and then allowing you to do research on what's active and what's smart beta. Finally, just to kind of drive home that point about the name doesn't matter all that much, the other thing I look at is what do people search for when they use our screener tool? And you would think that people would start off by saying, well, show me all passive ETFs or show me all active ETFs. They don't. The number one thing far and away is they click a little box that says very low fees on the left-hand side. And the threshold to be in that category is you've got to be south of 35 basis points, call it. And that's a floating scale. But that's the number one thing people search for. After that, they search for geography or what's the type of exposure they get. It's not until you get outside the top five in terms of criteria where you get to terms like smart beta or enhanced index that people are actually looking for. So obviously as a provider, we kind of skew towards retail, towards advisors, not so much institutional. But that's what we're seeing in the retail space is they just frankly don't care about the term. They're looking more what is the outcome and what is something that offers that outcome at a low price point.
Okay, great. And so I guess turning the question around a little bit, we talked a little bit about where smart beta strategies can win. What about active? So where does active continue to be sort of the choice, and where is that sort of win over a smart beta or another type of ETF product? I don't know if you want to
Maybe even put it in the context of separating good active from not so good active. And I know a lot of the studies people cite, like the SPIVA study, or the conversation always goes to defending the average active manager. And an average on everything often can be very, very misleading. And we think there's certainly a lot of dispersion in terms of the way assets are being managed. Characteristics of good active is already low fee. Things should be low fee. Things that look different than the benchmark, right? So benchmark agnostic, or however you want to talk about it. I mean, in contrast, benchmark hugging is a practice that many active managers will engage in, whether it's over the short term when they have to report each quarter, or just in general practice because there's so much pressure on outperformance. But that really shouldn't warrant a fee, right? I mean, if you're going to look pretty much like the benchmark, then you should be paying benchmark fees. Co-investment. I know Chris talked about this morning, but I think that's incredibly important that you're eating your own cooking and you have skin in the game, whether it's manager compensation, but you got to eat your own cooking. And it's amazing how many mutual funds have less, what Chris said today, 83% of actively managed equity ETFs have managers have less than $1 million in their own strategy. If you're not going to invest in your own thing, then it doesn't speak well. I think those are the really kind of the big things to look at, as well as I think long-term focus too. I mean, it's important to I think take a very long-term approach and be really measured.
Dodd mentioned the SPIVA study. That's something that in ETF circles you rely heavily on to make the case for passive management. Obviously, there's a vested interest there in the first S and the P, Standard & Poor's, and the indexing space to promote that narrative. One of the things we see, we've done our own research on this in active, and similar to Dodd and Davis, is looking at what are some very simple screens you can apply to active management to get you to a better spot and to get different results from what you see in the headlines and from studies like SPIVA. The two screens that we talk to our advisors and to our clients about using our fees. So Dodd mentioned that. The research we've done says if you look at the lowest quartile fees within any Morningstar category, the results are going to dramatically improve to the point where active in many categories outperforms passive if you're just looking at the lowest quartile fees. The other filter, and Dodd didn't mention this, but it's something that Fidelity believes in, is just working with well-resourced companies. So if you look at the top five asset managers, the global breadth they have in terms of their research capabilities, their analysts, their teams of 20 quants, in our case, have, that's going to lead you to better results as well. So when you combine those two filters to actively manage mutual funds, you get dramatically different results in terms of who's outperforming and who's underperforming. So that's our perspective on active. But that's not to say that everyone has to buy a stock-picking and bond-picking ETF in the future. I think we're going to do both. We're going to have rules-based passive, and we're going to have the full-blown active. And I think you're going to see this kind of three-layered approach of ETFs evolve, where the passive products are all beneath 10 basis points. The smart beta strategies will range from 10 to 30 basis points. And then the full-blown active managers will charge what they're worth, and the marketplace will dictate that. And that could be 30. That could be all the way up to 90 basis points based on the conviction, based on the tracking error, the risk in the portfolio, and the track record. So I think that's where we're heading in terms of ETF product adoption.
Okay, great.
I think I generally agree. The only thing I'll add on this is, you know, my personal view on this is that there are probably parts of the market where traditional passive makes more sense than other parts of the market. So in areas of the market where things are highly efficient, then, you know, the lowest cost exposure products probably make sense. And we have an active business, we have a passive business, so yeah, I'm not biased in any way. Maybe I am slightly, but not to a large degree. So, you know, there are areas of the market where it probably makes sense to use traditional passive. There's other parts of the market that are highly inefficient or more opaque. Like, for example, Matt mentioned fixed income. I would argue that active managers tend to do much better in that space because it's an over-the-counter market. There's still a lot of information issues. There's a lot of trading and liquidity issues. So an active manager can really bring their full toolkit to the table. So we do have some views around where passive makes sense, where smart beta makes sense, and where active makes sense. And we think about it more of a core satellite, right? So if you've got high conviction active managers that are actually giving you access to uncorrelated excess returns at a reasonable fee, 100% you should be looking at those managers. If there are smart beta strategies that give you exposures to static factors that have historically been rewarded, that probably belongs in your portfolio too. And there's parts of the market where it's tough to beat the index, just to be completely frank. And that's probably a traditional beta product at the cheapest level that you can find it. So I don't want to promote Matt's platform, but go to Matt's platform.
Thanks.
It's so interesting. You know, the conversation over the years is kind of evolved and shifted. And at one point, it was sort of active or passive, and that didn't last very long. Most people saw right through that. Then it goes active and passive, and that's not super insightful either, but it's kind of a view of the obvious. But now it's kind of, you know, how do you think about combining the two, and what's a real thoughtful approach in which to do it, and what are some frameworks to do it? You know, to me, you know, I distill it down to level of conviction and core competency. I mean, let's face it, as advisors, you can't be experts and managers in all different areas. You really got to have belief, if you are going active, that who's behind the wheel is going to pay for their fee and add alpha and outperform. And that takes a good amount of work and a high degree of faith. And in practice, I mean, I think this has existed for years with arguably the world's largest and most sophisticated investors, U.S. Pension funds. And if P&I does a study every year, or survey rather, and you look at, you know, what percent of defined benefit plans is active and what is passive. And the only consistency I can find is that it's generally around 50-50, at least from an average perspective. Sometimes it varies. And to me, what really drives that is their level of conviction. Some people are 100% active in fixed income. Some are 100% passive in fixed income. But they're using both, and you really having their kind of level of conviction drive that.
And I think Todd's point about blending active and passive, that's something we're doing in real time. Fidelity has a number of large cap blend, large cap growth, actively managed mutual fund portfolios. Our ETF, or one of the ETFs we offer in the large cap space, is FDLO. It's a low volatility ETF. And I had one gatekeeper, a due diligence analyst, refer to it as mild sauce. It's sector neutral, it's size neutral, the stock bets are capped, it's very plain vanilla, but it's an excellent complement to the large cap growth strategies we run in a mutual fund wrapper. Because Fidelity is an active manager, you do have some flexibility to go outside the benchmark, to buy international names, to buy smaller cap names. So if you add FIDLO, the low volatility ETF, to that portfolio, you could potentially reduce risk if you're a more conservative investor while still getting access to the bottoms-up stock picking that's offered by the large cap growth strategy. So that's some of the work we're doing is showing customers what the blend is of the smart beta ETFs that we have versus the existing actively managed mutual funds they already own.
I think one point I'll make in terms of good active versus bad active, and Dodd alluded to this and hit this a bit, I think tracking error is actually an important thing to look at. So if an active manager is running very low tracking error to an index, that's probably something that should raise a red flag in your mind. The other thing is, if the excess return, you know, isn't material enough to make up for the excess fee, that's probably a red flag as well, right? So if it hasn't produced results that beat the benchmark or even a composite index that potentially has static factor exposures that manager claims to be kind of focused on. For example, if they're a value manager, I wouldn't compare them just against a regular benchmark. I'd compare them against the static value index, right? And if they can't beat that index, then that's a problem, right? Because I can get that particular strategy at a much different price point with smart beta. So tracking error and excess return relative to excess fee, I think, are two things that people should be looking at.
And so what about, as we think of, so certainly, obviously, this makes sense from a manufacturing standpoint, and it seems to make sense for the investor, but what about distribution and educating the retail investor? And I think it's sort of easy enough to imagine the institutional conversation with an institutional client, but given sort of different distribution strategies, how do you educate the investor, and how do you sort of sell this package that seems to make a lot of sense?
So the playbook we're running is almost the playbook from 10 years ago. 10 years ago, I always joke, I worked for Dodd. Dodd was my first boss out of college, and they used to make us stand up and give these five-minute presentations on ETF creation, redemption, and how the shares are actually exchanged in kind, and you had to have that presentation down in terms of how the ETF works. The advisor community and the institutional community already know that. We're not spending any time on ETF education. The retail masses, the 7 or 8 million households that we have on our platform, are not aware of that. And you could argue in some cases maybe they don't need to know. They jump in a car every day. They don't know how the engine works. Maybe they don't need to know how the mechanics of an ETF works. But we're kind of running the playbook from 10 years ago in terms of educating people about the ETF structure, why you might use it. We're not even at the point of really active versus smart beta versus passive for that population. And that's something I'd leave you all with, is just how early it is in ETF adoption in the retail space. I was sharing over lunch the percent of households on our platform that own any ETF, not just a Fidelity ETF, but one from iShares, Vanguard, whoever. It's only 10% of our households, compared to 40% that own an active equity mutual fund from Fidelity. So every year we come to these events and we talk about the growth of the industry and 2017 shaping up to be a record year for ETF flows. I'm confident you're going to keep seeing those flows as retail customers start to use ETFs for the first time. It's really early, so we're spending a lot of our time on baseline education on the ETF structure.
Yeah, I think for us, you know, it depends on the client, right? So absolutely would agree. You know, there's definitely some educational components of how we talk about the ETF market. You know, how is traditional beta different than smart beta versus active? And even more fundamentally, how does the ETF actually work? And, you know, primary liquidity versus secondary liquidity, creation, redemption. Definitely those are some things that we do, especially in broad retail. On the more sophisticated side, on the more institutional side, it's all about, okay, you know, what exactly is the outcome? What's the methodology? How are you getting your exposures? Do you have any unintended exposures? And even things like SEC lending and other things that you might not necessarily talk about every day will come up, right? So how much revenue is SEC lending producing, right? So if your fee is 30 basis points and it's a small cap ETF and you've got great SEC lending splits, well, how much of my fee is being made up because you're lending the underlying portfolio? So if you can generate 15 basis points from SEC lending and your fee is 30, then I'm going to say it's 15 actually because you've given me something back. So it really depends. I think we've got the whole spectrum. We'll do 101 education all the way to 401 education and really get to the heart of some of the more sophisticated strategies.
And every customer is different. I think that's something I see a lot in the ETF space is they'll talk about ETFs versus mutual funds as if the same customer is buying both. In the ETF market, you have, earlier you heard the state of New Jersey's pension program or retirement system talking about how they use it. The same customer that I'm talking about that has $200,000 in a Fidelity account buys that same security. So the education levels and the way we talk to individual customers, it's all about the same ticker, but we're having very different conversations based on the client that we're talking to.
Yeah, we're having pretty unique experience being one of kind of the first transparent, actively managed ETFs. So I kind of bucket a lot of our educational, and the focus is really on education, into two buckets. One is for the folks that know Davis and have been investing us with their mutual funds or other structures. It's a lot about, you know, ETFs and why are they so tax efficient. And one line of conversation that we're doing a ton of education on is the trading part of ETFs, the T in ETFs, best practices in trading, because there are folks that we run across that have never, you know, really, they're just buying mostly mutual funds, right? And buying something at end of day at NAV is very different than doing a limit order and not doing a trade at the open and the close. So there's kind of that blocking and tackling or explaining to them why you would expect less in capital gains distributions with an ETF over a mutual fund than a taxable account. So we have asset location types of conversations. You know, the other is, and we're spending a lot of time on this as well, is talking to traditional ETF users that are looking at the equity space and really for one of the first times they have they're in a position to be at a position to outperform, and we're educating on our investment discipline and our strategy and, you know, what is behind our whole stock selection process. So it's kind of both of those, and it's a lot of work.
So Dodd brought up a good point about trading. I think that's another area we're spending a ton of time on. When I look at our platform, 70% of the order flow is using market orders. And that might sound scary. It's actually not that bad. As you heard from the liquidity providers earlier, Chris Hempstead and Reggie Brown and that whole crew, market orders, if they're traded appropriately, work really well. In some cases, where they don't work well is illiquid ETFs, or if the customer is placing a market order, and this does happen a fair amount, when the market's closed. And then that just becomes a market on open order. Yep. So if you remember from the earlier panel, I think it was Reggie that was talking about don't place market orders at the open. That's what happens when you place a market order anytime after the market closes. It just goes to the next day. So certainly we could do a lot to educate, but I think we're starting to think through what are some potential technology solves for that on the platform level to help customers get best trading practices when they are specifically trading ETFs because they're different from trading stocks.
There is so much time spent on the trading component of it, and related to that, the myth as well, that I would say a vast majority of advisors, investors still hold to this day, which I think most of us that have been in the industry for a while would say that it's primarily false, and that's that average daily volume or fund size is a good proxy for the capacity of an ETF to accommodate a large trade, and that is completely false. We have a financial fund that trades 20, 30,000 shares a day. Last Thursday, we executed a $10 million trade. So how is that possible? And so we spend a lot of time kind of educating that, but we find that a big mistake a lot of advisors and investors make is they write ETFs off that haven't hit some arbitrary high watermarks. That shouldn't be a reason if it's a compelling exposure for them to put money in. Now, don't get me wrong, I'd much prefer an ETF that's highly liquid because it's adding a tremendous amount of efficiency and often can allow you to invest in a market in a more efficient way than if you had the size, scale, and ability to buy every line item in a program trade. That's an amazing benefit that ETFs are delivering to the marketplace. But I find all too often people write off ETFs until they hit 100 million or 500 million, and that shouldn't always be the case.
In some cases, even if it is at a small dollar amount and the advisor believes that the ETF structure is sound and they can trade a big portion of the size, they still have the issue of bandwidth. I mean, many of these advisors don't have the time in the middle of the day to trade portfolios, and they'll put limit orders that go unfilled, or they'll have to employ a junior level analyst or ops person or trader to actually implement the portfolios. As awesome as ETFs are, and they are great, it's still in some cases, especially for smaller investors, time intensive to actually get into the portfolio when you're trading it. It can be. I shouldn't say it is. It can be based on the products you're using. So I think that's another concern too, is even if you believe in the ETF, how much time are you going to take to actually trade it appropriately, to pick up the phone, to use RFQ software, which is now becoming all the rage, to get quotes from the street? That takes time. And I've found some advisors are not willing to take that time, even if they think the ETF is a better structure.
I mean, I think if you really just get to the basics, right? I mean, the only difference between an ETF and another fund is this exchange-traded portion of it, right? And if somebody has a bad experience on exchange, you know, in terms of their execution, that reflects negatively on the ETF. But to Dodd's point and to Matt's point, it's really about making sure people understand how to trade the product. And it does take a bit more time and a little bit more research in terms of getting into the market. So we're very concerned about that. I think we have done what other firms have done and established a capital markets desk that focuses on client execution services, right? So that desk isn't there to make money, right? It represents, it's supposed to be helping our clients, right, get invested. So there's no economics in it for that capital markets desk. It's all about providing a service, a white glove service. So if there's any client that needs help with a product, whether it's highly liquid or maybe it's a little bit smaller and you need to tap the primary market or the creation redemption process, we say reach out. It's one phone call. It's not going to cost you anything.
I think in that regard, most ETF providers now have that type of capital markets function, and it feels a little bit like a cashier at a grocery store. You've already picked the items off the shelf, and you're just looking for kind of the quickest line that's going to get you through the line in the most efficient way possible. That's kind of what that capital markets function represents. I think it's interesting to see the space evolve, where our capital markets team that does the same function that most team does, they actually pipe into Fidelity's true capital markets desk, an actual trading desk that is actually executing those trades on behalf of RIAs. So it's really cool to kind of see how our ETF capital markets team interacts with our Fidelity capital markets team to get the trade done on behalf of the advisor.
Okay, great. So I have a couple more questions, but I thought I would take a moment to see if there's questions in the audience.
Matt and Dot, perhaps. Let's talk about the profitability of the business for a company that's issuing ETFs. Roughly, in the U.S. market, how much money you can make in a year by stock lending?
Oh, from the underlying lending?
From the underlying lending, because at 30 basis points, it's peanuts. You have a 1 billion ETF, and you hardly make any few millions there money on the fee on the ETF. So the main money-making, I guess, and I want to hear your opinion, is stock lending and principal trading and hedging on the principal book.
Yeah, so
give us an idea on the profit.
Sure. I don't have the hard numbers in front of me, but there's two ways to think about lending. So earlier you heard State of New Jersey talk about they will go long HYG, the high yield bond ETF, and then lend those out into the open market. And I think Kevin mentioned it was a 300 basis point spread. So there's money to be made by lending out your long positions to the street. I think your question is more about the underlying portfolio. I remember years ago we looked at State Street had SPY, which is technically a UIT. And if I'm not mistaken, they don't actually lend in the portfolio because it's a UIT structure. IVV from iShares does lend. And it varies based on largely, I think, volatility and what the short interest is in the particular security. So at that time, it was a few basis points, but those are multi-billion dollar portfolios. And I would argue it does add up. But you see them move around a ton. You see it a lot in the biotech space, in the retail space, some of these industry level where the lending revenue from the underlying components will change on a year-to-year basis based on what the short interest is in those individual securities. So unfortunately, I don't have hard data on our platform, but that's kind of how I think about it. It's largely driven on the short interest in the underlying names is how much incremental revenue. Because the splits that the providers give to the shareholders are largely favorable, right? Meaning they're giving the majority of the proceeds of the underlying revenue to you, the shareholder.
And it depends on the model, right? So a lot of ETF sponsors are not their own SEC lending agent, so they actually have no economic interest in that lend, right? So, for example, we don't participate in securities lending. You know, our custodian does that for us, and the splits are very fair. The fund gets the benefit after, obviously, paying the custodian to do what we need them to do. It depends on the asset class, right? So a small cap ETF will generate more SEC lending revenue than a large cap ETF. So it really depends. Most of that benefit is going back to the fund, right? So it's a very important point. So when we think about it, we think about that as from a total cost of ownership standpoint. You know, your expense ratio is a negative. This is a positive for you, right? So you can add them up and actually maybe your total cost is a lot lower. And assuming you're getting good execution on exchange, that also factors into your total cost of ownership. The only other thing I'll say about the SEC lending part is, or just the business itself. You asked the question around profitability. Is it a profitable business to run at these low fees? There's actually a misconception. I think people confuse revenues from margins, right? So absolute number, it's 4 basis points, but at scale, the margins are incredibly good because you don't have to hire 10 more portfolio managers. You don't have to hire 50 more operations people, right? It's a very scalable business. So if you can get to that scale, even at low expense ratios, your margins are fantastic.
Okay, great. I think there was a question over there. There's one over here.
Thank you. A question. I thought I heard correctly that Matt had mentioned that for the mutual funds and ETFs, same fee structure. Dodd, is that true as well for Davis?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was going to chime in on trying to figure the right angle to get in.
I was
in
probably
on
talking too much that Dodd didn't get it.
No, not at all. I think it's a really good point, too. So our net expense ratios are slightly different in the ETF than the mutual fund, but importantly, the management fee that we charge, the management fee, the portion of your total expense ratio is exactly the same for the ETF as it is for our mutual funds as well. The reason there's a difference is this other expenses category. And with an exchange-traded fund, we believe that it should be slightly lower from a net expense ratio because there's less shareholder accounting costs with ETFs, as well as the total cost of investing in an ETF is more than just your expense ratio, right? You have your trading costs if there's a commission. If you're lucky enough to not pay a commission, you're still having market impact and bid-ask spreads. So in general, your total cost is more than just your expense ratio. We think it should be slightly lower. But we did, importantly, from a strategic standpoint, want to be agnostic in terms of, as Matt said, we don't want to drive people to the ETF and away from the mutual fund or vice versa. We want to provide them choice and do it in an equitable way in the delivery vehicle that they want to access.
And I should clarify my point. They were the same expense ratio, but one of the things that's happened since then is we've launched Z-share versions of some of our mutual fund strategies that are a lower price point or looking at zero revenue share classes. So for large wrap programs and retirement plans, you can get access to a cheaper total expense ratio. And I have heard the feedback that Dodd's gotten, too, which is I pay a bid-ask spread, I pay a commission for the ETF. The ETF should be cheaper. That's something that we're thinking through in real time is what's equilibrium. I think the problem that we heard from many of the major brokerage firms in this country is that they wanted parity for a long time so that they weren't driving money into one particular product. That was something that our customers were asking us for at the time 3 years ago, but I think DOL has caused people to revisit that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree. I mean, ETFs should be cheaper, right, because operationally they're cheaper to run. So that benefit should be passed on to the shareholders or to the investors. If you think about ETFs, right, the only people that interact with the ETF itself are the authorized participants. A mutual fund obviously has a very diverse number of investors, right? So that operational burden that it introduces costs something, right? So I think I agree with Dodd's point and Matt's point. The management fee you pay, right, the advisor providing investment advice, that should be the same. But if there's benefits from one running one structure versus the other, you should pass those benefits back to the investors.
Okay, with that, I see a couple more questions, but unfortunately I think we're out of time, so I'm sorry we couldn't get to them all, but hopefully you all can catch up later in the day if that's possible. Thanks so much for a great panel. And thanks, everyone, for your attendance.
Thank you.
Thank you.